Any questions from your discussions? Yep. Give the girl the microphone. Yeah.
Okay. So, becoming a nun, you decided not to have sex.
Well, also to not kill, not steal, not lie. What?
You decrease the quantity of humans in the world, and therefore you decrease...
I don't think there's any problem about... I don't think you have any concern. I don't think you should worry. And anyway, that's preferable. We want to get all out the hell out of samsara, don't we? We want to get out of samsara, baby, so the less sex, the better.
It's true that there are less human beings.
What?
There are less human beings, and if you want to become a Buddha, you have to be in a human package.
Yeah, that's right.
So maybe less human beings.
Okay, so what's the problem? I understand, I'm joking, but not. So what's your problem? What's the concern? What's the question actually?
In principle, there should be. If there are more human beings in the world, then there are more possibilities to rebirth.
Okay, so what's your question? What's the question, darling? Just make it a question. It's good. Make it a question.
If there is a contradiction in deciding.
Okay, so maybe your better question is why would a person want to give up sex? That's probably the better question, isn't it? Surely that's a better question. It's a more fundamental question. Would you like me to answer that question? You don't want to know about that question. You want your question.
Yeah, no, it was slightly different.
Darling, I understand your point. Mm-hmm. But you have to... So in order to answer your question, I have to answer the... You have to know why the Buddha would exhort us to give up, anybody who wants to give up give up having sexual activity. Do you want to know why Buddha would exhort us to do that? Do you want to know why?
Yes.
Okay, good. But just to say to your point, I should think you have no problem in worrying about too many people giving up sex. I don't think it's going to happen, so don't get nervous. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Anyway, that's not the issue. But listen, that's not my issue though. I don't care about that. That's not the issue here. So I'll try and tell you why Buddha would exhort us to live in vows, including no sexual contact. Okay. As you know from Buddha's teachings and what we've discussed, he talks about giving up attachment, yeah? Have you heard that, haven't you? And you've heard how attachment is causing suffering, even though it's hard for us to hear it, because we all love attachment. So would you agree that attachment to having sexual contact with human beings or other bodies is quite, not just humans, but is a strong imprint in all sentient beings that you can see, all the creatures, all the animals. You can see that, right? Okay, and you can see that, as we discussed, the more pleasure we have in response to a contact with any kind of object indicates the strength of the habit. So clearly, sexual contact is quite a habit, must be karmically over many eons of time. Would you agree with that? So, attachment's the main cause of suffering. Attachment is the main cause of suffering. So it would help if you want to give up attachment. It really helps to remove yourself from the objects. Then it's easy to go to the mountains, get single point of concentration, start to unpack and unravel all the delusions, get rid of the delusions, get renunciation, realize emptiness, and get the hell out of samsara. Now, once you're out of samsara, you can have 27 boyfriends. Don't worry about it. You can have sex with as much as you like coming out your ears because you won't be creating negative karma. So it's not a problem, okay? Just become a holy being first. Are you getting my point? Thank you. Come on. I'm dying to be a bodhisattva next life and I have 27 boyfriends. I can't wait. I've just got to give up attachment first and realize emptiness. Then you're cool, baby. I'm not joking, but I'm joking. But get the point. Because attachment... When you've got delusions, is a straight to the hell realms. You won't want to worry about sex in the hell realms, baby, because you've got a body of fire. You've got more worries than just worrying about a boyfriend. Are we communicating?
Yes, but I
heard your question already, but when you hear the bigger picture, you don't have to have a problem about it. Just become a bodhisattva first. Then you can keep, you know, regenerating humans on the planet, hopefully decent ones. You with me? You sure? You content? Thank you. Any other questions? Any other questions? Yes, yes. Kira, you first. No, either way, it doesn't matter. Go, darling.
Talking about the death process that we were talking about this morning.
Yes.
What's the Buddhist view about heavy sedation, euthanasia?
You know about euthanasia, Kira, already. Yes. We've discussed it many times.
Yeah, but nowadays, for example...
I know, I don't care. We've discussed it many times.
Yes.
Well, what do you mean, yeah? So tell me what you understand. Tell me what you understand. We discussed killing a mouse, and we also discussed the same principle as killing your grandma. Why would Buddha suggest that's not such a good idea under normal circumstances? Why would that be a problem?
Well, just to stop the karmic...
What would be a problem with you killing somebody?
Would you kill somebody?
Yes, a mouse or your grandma. Based on our discussions, remember?
Yeah, it would be a problem of understanding whether I'm doing this out of...
No, nothing to do with you. Nothing to do with you.
Okay.
If you don't have the wisdom to see the mind of the mouse or your grandmother and with confidence know that if you kill them now that they will get a really good human rebirth and meet the Dalai Lama and carry on their spiritual practice, then you have no business killing anybody because you don't have the wisdom to be certain that it will benefit them in the future life. That's the logic behind it. It's a practical issue. Can you hear that? Can you hear that?
I do.
Okay.
What?
So then?
How about if I were the patient?
What about it? So if you're the patient, then what? Then what's the question? What's the question, darling?
I mean, would that be okay?
What do you mean, okay, Kira? Kira, if you take the view, we're discussing in this room Buddha's view. We're taking the big picture. And the big picture is we have consciousnesses that carry on from life to life. Would you accept that? That's the discussion in this room. So obviously, as we've been discussing about the death process, the main concern is to help a person die peacefully and virtuously, as we discussed this morning, because then a virtuous karmic seed hopefully would be triggered, which will ensure they get a decent human rebirth. Now, if you don't have that wisdom, Kira... If you don't have that wisdom, then why would you want to facilitate a person to be born in the lower realms? Why would you want to do that, Kira? Why would you want to? Can you hear the point I'm trying to make?
I totally.
Then therefore you have the answer to your question, darling. And if you haven't, then ask me another question.
If the patient is not dying peacefully, because sometimes they're not.
That's right. Many people don't die peacefully. Exactly. So what's the question? What's the question, darling? That's a different discussion. You talked about killing them before. So what's your question now?
No,
it's different.
No, I asked two questions.
I know, but they're both different answers. So which one now? You're discussing...
It's about sedation.
Oh, so now it's sedation, not killing them.
No.
You're satisfied with that answer?
Yes, I am.
Good, okay. So now the person you want... Is it valid to give sedation to a person?
Right.
The same principle applies. The main concern, as we discussed this weekend, is from based on Lama Zopa's teachings, is to do everything in our power to help a person's mind be peaceful. And when they're peaceful, their mind can be virtuous. And when their mind is virtuous, they can then, that when they do die, that will trigger a virtuous karmic seed, which will ensure that they take a decent human rebirth in the future. That's the main concern. That's the main concern. So I would say, contrary to a lot of the understanding in our culture, it's not appropriate to drug people out of their brains because we think, oh, they look so peaceful. Look at them. But they're not. They're having a nightmare. They're tormented with misery and pain. In other words, you can medicate physical pain. You can't medicate mental anguish, darling. So everything in your power to help a person, that's why if you're there, you're loving them, you're taking care, you're supporting them, you're giving them some sedation, but they're able to be conscious so you can help their mind be virtuous. That's the most important job. We can't guarantee that they'll all die happily, but this is the way we can help. This is from Lama Zopa's book. This is the most important point, sweetheart. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Good, good, good. Yeah.
Okay, so we were talking about the jhamwa, the blessing that remains.
Mm-hmm.
And could you explain how it works when the consciousness is already maybe in a different body?
It's the power of the Buddhas. The power of the Buddhas. I think we've got to think about that because initially that just sounds religious and weird to us. But when we begin to understand what an enlightened being is and their immense power, and I'm really quite immense power, then any practices we do that invoke the Buddhas can benefit the sentient beings. And so Lama Zopa says, even a bone that's 1,000 years old. If you say mantra, and as we discussed before, you say mantra, you bless your breath. So for the power of mantra, because it's connected to the Buddhas and it blesses your breath and you blow on a bone, because of the karmic connection between that bone and the being who is now in another body 1,000 years later, because of the karmic connection between that consciousness and that consciousness will get the benefit. There's so many practices we can do to benefit sentient beings in the hell realms, in other realms, because of the power of these practices. This is Rinpoche's main concern in his book. And this is new to us, because if we're materialists, this makes it doesn't make sense, you know. So we've got to think about all that. Do you understand? Yeah, who was there? Somebody. Yeah, no other questions. Okay, so we just have a half an hour before we stop our session. So I think now we mentioned that we'd gone through the death process. We've been through, you know, the way to live our lives in relation to impermanence. And we just again, as I said before, we just began the compassion, the compassion wing, so we can have some framework, some context for this transforming problems teaching. So let's look then, as I mentioned before, look at these different techniques that we can practice that culminate in the achievement of bodhicitta. So I said in the tradition, as you know, in the tradition from all our lamas, coming from the great Nalanda tradition, this great monastic university system that all the great scholars that our lamas use as the basis of their study, you know, the two of the practices that are cultivated by that they use, one is called the six causes and one effect, or the 7 point something or other. And the other one is called exchanging self for others. Well, like I mentioned, there's this nice little kind of series of techniques that Bhobongkhar Rinpoche talks about where he puts these two together. So it turns into 11 little techniques. So we began, I think, that's right, we began talking about equanimity. So let's go back to equanimity. We started talking now, I forget now. I remember, we did. So let's go to more depth about equanimity. So like I said, you know, in the teachings, if you look at the Theravadin level of the teachings, the Hinayana level, it's kind of the first and second scope, or junior school and high school, like I like to call it, or the wisdom wing, the equanimity that we would develop based upon working on our minds and getting renunciation, stabilizing our body, speech, and mind, we'd have real equanimity within our own mind, steady, stable, not up and down like yo-yos. But here, equanimity, like I mentioned, is a different equanimity, and it's in relation to sentient beings. So like I said, you know, we discussed, like I said, if we want to divide all the universe into all the sentient beings, we can divide into three categories. There's no fourth. And as I said, they're the objects of the three poisons, the three toxic emotions. You've got the objects of attachment, the objects of aversion, and the objects of indifference. So whereas in the earlier stages, remember we discussed the 10 non-virtues that Buddha discussed, and the last three are related to the mind. And here he exhorts us to lessen the grosser levels of attachment, this intense craving, the grosser levels of anger, which is like this ill will, wanting people to suffer, never giving up anger. And then the third one is a particular manifestation, like I mentioned, of this ego grasping, the root delusion, the root ignorance. One manifestation there is this very fundamentalist state of mind. I'm right, you're wrong. We've all got it, but we can really see it's a very gross aspect of ignorance. And look in the world, fundamentalist politicians, fundamentalist religious people, very narrow-minded, ignorant, very ignorant mind. So there, that's one aspect, one manifestation we can see of ego grasping, the root delusion. But here, if we look in relation to sentient beings, in relation to what we call strangers, friends are those we adore, whom we have attachment for. Enemies are those we don't like, whom we have aversion for, and 99.99% of the others are called strangers because they've neither harmed nor helped us. So we have, what do we have towards them in this particular framework? The manifestation of ego grasping, the manifestation of ignorance, is indifference, couldn't care. It's a type of ignorance, isn't it? You just don't care. We don't even see strangers because they don't affect us. We vividly remember and think about the people who've harmed us. We vividly think about and remember the people who've helped us because we have attachment and aversion to them. We hold them close, kind of ironically. But strangers are just literally distant. We just can't see a real person there because they haven't touched our lives. So therefore, we're profoundly indifferent. So we can see this. This is the world. Monkeys are like this. Dogs, ants, humans. Because this is the, you know, as we discussed, this is the Buddhist model of the mind. It refers to all living beings, not just humans. So the equanimity here is really specific. And as I'm talking, as I said earlier this morning, as we began to discuss, as we're discussing now, all the different logical reasons we can use to break down the misconceptions of ego that prevent us from seeing very clearly, which is what equanimity is, that enemy and friend and stranger, and this is the meaning, the essence of equanimity. It's very simple, very clear. This is heartfelt recognition, when we've got it, that the friend, the enemy, and the stranger, the object of attachment, the object of aversion, and the object of indifference, are equal to each other from one point of view. That's it. Their wish to be happy and their wish not to suffer. It's really specific. I think all these, you know, because we're not used to using logic and analysis, certainly in terms of developing love and compassion, we kind of think it's all this nice feelings and things. But the Buddhist view, as we can see, is we've got to use logic and clarity to argue with ego's really deluded misconceptions, you know. These misconceptions are really gross stories that our mind has made up. So we've got to use wisdom and clarity to argue with them. And this is what's so powerful about getting these different, developing these different series of techniques that culminate in bodhicitta. It's not a question of just meditating and getting a nice feeling. That's too emotional. That doesn't last. So right now, having ignorance, having attachment, we therefore have attachment to the beautiful ones who do what we want, who do what our attachment want. We have aversion to those who don't do what our attachment want, and we couldn't care less about the rest. So we've got to change this radically. Buddha's saying we can have love and compassion for every single sentient being. So we start with this logic of equanimity. Now our logic, so-called ego's logic, which is not logic, is I do have love and I do have compassion, but usually for that first group only. The ones who make us happy. My beloved boyfriend, Ron. I adore Ron. I have attachment for Ron, so therefore I do love Ron. I want him to be happy. I do have compassion for Ron. I want him not to suffer. So we do have love and compassion, but as Rinpoche says, it's unstable because it's based on attachment. So the Buddha is trying to get us to see on this Mahayana path that we do have the capability of developing love and compassion beyond these three poisons. This is pretty intense, you know. So we've got to use some logic for why we would want other people to be happy, that is to love them. Why would we want to have compassion, that is to wish them not to suffer? It's because they want it. That's the simple reasoning here. Right now it's because it suits me. I've got a vested interest in loving and being compassionate towards Ron because he makes me happy. But we all know if he moves into the enemy category because he gives me up for the younger version, my love and compassion turn off like a tap. We know this. We know this. So of course this is intense. We think about it. These simple concepts, they're really powerful. Look at our daily lives, you know. Attachment, aversion, ignorance, like we've been talking, run the show. Inform everyone we see. Within a minute, we divide everybody we know into these three categories. Those we like, those we don't like, and those we don't care about. That's it. And all of they are labels, they're viewpoints we have created directly in relation to how they affect us. In other words, we're totally self-centered. I mean, it's embarrassing. We should be embarrassed. It's a totally self-centered view. We see the whole world through the lenses of our delusions. If it's attachment, they look gorgeous, so we're happy to love and have compassion for them. If they're horrible and don't do what my attachment wants, they're ugly, and we try not to want them to suffer, but it's very easy to wish them to suffer. We certainly don't want them to not suffer. We certainly don't have love for them. And the strangers, we just don't even go there. We don't even notice strangers. We're blind. So this idea of equanimity is already profound, and this is the first of the 11. This is intense, you know. These teachings on the Bodhisattva path, we love to think of a spiritual path as got all love, compassion, blah, 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 like these nice feelings. It's pretty powerful stuff, I tell you. So equanimity. So how do you apply that in daily life? Well, remember what we tried to prove, that a person who is kind to me and a person who is unkind to me and a person who does neither, they equally wish to be happy and not suffer. And we've got to try and prove that. That's the point here, to be convinced about it. So how do you prove that to yourself? Well, I think it's fairly easy, you know. You know, use this as an example. So let's say you've got these three people in front of you right now, in your mind. To the left in front of you is a divine, one of your beloveds. To the right, to the middle in front of you is a person who simply doesn't like you. We're using you as the reference point here. The person to your left in front of you looking at you with dazzled eyes thinks you're gorgeous. And for them, you are called friend. Now, the person in front of you who can't stand you because maybe you cheated on them or something and they can't bear you. As far as they're concerned, they see an ugly person. You're an enemy. You're their enemy. The person to the right whose face you can put there just enough because you know who they are and they've just met you briefly. But you've neither harmed nor helped this person. So when they look at you, they just see a boring, indifferent person, don't they? So they three see threats. They see three separate people. If they wrote a description of you, you would never recognize in each description that they're talking about the same person. Because each of them is dumping their own projections onto you. One sees you through the lens of attachment. One sees you through the lens of aversion. One sees you through the lens of indifference. And they describe three completely different people. Now, you know that. But it's quite irrelevant. You are who you are every second. Whether they see you this way or that doesn't have any bearing on what you think, who you are, how you feel. This is clear. So it's clear friend, enemy, stranger are descriptions that those three people have invented based upon their own neurotic mind, based upon their own misconceptions, based upon their own disturbing emotions. They've created three separate pictures of you. So the reality is when someone asks you, someone asks you, when the friend is looking at you and someone says to you, do you want to be happy? Yes, please. Do you want to suffer? Yes, please. Oh, no, thank you. Sorry, wrong one. While the enemy's looking at you, there's absolutely no difference. You don't feel like an enemy. You don't feel ugly. You feel the same person. So you want to be happy. You don't want to suffer every second, whether you're called friend, enemy, or stranger. It's so obvious. We'll just swap it over. It's the same for them. But part of our problem, especially if, the mean husband has given you up for the younger version and you have really hurt and really have been hurt by this person, guaranteed, then to hear, oh, he wants to be happy. The first thing we say is, what do you mean he wants to be happy? Think of people right now you don't like. The first response is, what do you mean they want to be happy? And then what will we say is, we will then say, they don't deserve to be happy. So that means we have this thing that our wishing they be happy is contingent on their making me happy. That's what we mean by deserve. They've got to make me happy. Then they deserve it. That's why I want Ron to be happy. So all this is inbuilt in our minds. All these are assumptions. We don't question these assumptions because they're so deep, And as we can see from samsara, monkeys, dogs, and ants are exactly the same. This is universal. This is Buddha's view of the entire universe, So these are pretty intense to try and change these. So what we're trying to do is get out of the equation and see these three separate people as having nothing to do with you. They're three separate people. Get out. Mind your own business. Back off, And try and see them as separate. This is already powerful. They might have harmed you and they might have helped you and one might have done neither. That's not the issue here. This is the point. In a sense, Buddha's saying, excuse me, Rabina, just because Ron, has harmed you, and I agree that he has, Buddha might say, that's nothing, what's that got to, that's not relevant. That is not relevant here. Just because he's harmed you has nothing to do whether he wants to be happy or not. In fact, the reason he left you is because he wants to be happy. That's a really good logical reason, although it's very hurtful. We've got to argue with these things and see how utterly self-centered this simple view of friend, enemy, stranger is. I mean, because it's so normal, we never question it. And it's quite shocking to question it. It's quite kind of radical. Buddha's radical in how he sees things, But we're so used to talking about in this kind of whole leaf, kind of gooey way. Oh, I've had such a lovely meditation. Oh, I loved everybody. The next minute someone shouts and you get mad at them. It's too superficial. It's too emotional, And here it's got nothing to do with feelings. We're very addicted to feelings, I don't care about feelings. We've got to use logic because ego is a real liar. It's so tricky. So we've got to see the logic. Get yourself out of it. Okay, maybe you're not ready to see that Ron wants to be happy yet because it's too painful for you. Fair enough. But if you use yourself, the first example I use is very powerful. If you have cheated on Ron and Ron sees you with daggers and Ron thinks you're a horrible enemy, then You know, if you look into your own mind, even though you're his enemy, you're called enemy when Ron looks at you, but you know you want to be happy in exactly the same way as when your beloved looks at you, when suddenly, you know, you're looking like a friend. So it's no different. So anything that works for our mind, we have to use to see the proof of this, you know. But it's not easy. Let's say you're a grandparent, and you've got your little gorgeous grandchild whom you think, you know, is a saint, and they're going to play with a smelly kid next door. You can't stand this kid. Well, right there you can practice equanimity. Right there, that second. This smelly kid feels exactly like your precious kid. They want to be happy and don't want to suffer. This is something, we're not going any further than just this point here. This is the basis upon which we will gradually grow genuine love and compassion. But you've got to get the foundation stable first. And this already is profound practice. Just equanimity, logically proving continuously in your own daily life experiences, you know? Like you see a stranger, we hardly even notice a stranger because they don't impact upon our life. So just look a little bit longer, 1 second longer. They want to be happy, just like my friend. They want to be happy, they don't want to suffer, just like my beloved, you know? And you stop for a second, and just saying those words, kind of you begin to, you see a human being there, you know? Because when we realize the depth of attachment and therefore aversion and therefore ignorance, which roots them, these are informing every millisecond of what we think and do and say, every second, even when we're nice people. This is what we've been trying to point out. I mean, it's a bit depressing to hear how deep these delusions are, but this is Buddha's view, you know. His view of the mind is way more radical than we could ever imagine and way more radical in the depth of these unhappy emotions, you know, in his view of them. So way to go. So you don't just practice on your cushion and get a nice gooey feeling about all lovely sentient beings. You do this every single day because every day in the traffic, at work, in the Buddhist center, you've already divided the people into three categories. Guaranteed. There are those you like, those you don't, and those you don't care about. That's it. There's no fourth category because these are the three root delusions, the three toxic emotions. So it's a very integrated view, you know. We can work on this as much as we can throughout the day. At least recognize she wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer, just like my beloved, the person whom you don't like. It's shocking. It's profound, you know. So then what? Then what? What do you do with that? Then what? This is the basis. This is the foundation. And if that's shaky, you can't get far, as you can't go forward much. So as we know in these 11 techniques, there's sort of these little techniques that have been cultivated over centuries, you know, kind of cultivated by our great yogis, the great yogis in Tibet coming back from the yogis in India. So there's this little point that comes that we need to think about. This is like you need your calculator for this one. Given that our consciousness is beginningless and endless, and given that there are countless trillions of sentient beings whose consciousnesses are beginning and endless, the next point we go to contemplate is therefore, you could argue, we've bumped into each other countless times. But here, more specifically, we're using the example of a mother, which is very Asian. Very, some of us love our mothers. So the example of a mother, as His Holiness says, is a person who's nurtured you, has loved you. But in our culture, we know we don't like our mums often. We think they're maniacs, and they probably are. I mean, join the universe here. We're all deluded. So as he says, well, if you can't think about your mum, think about persons who's nurtured you. But the idea of the mother is simply because it's an example of a person who, since you're conceived, has kind of taken care of you. So this first point is simply that all sentient beings have been our mother. Now, the next point makes it more logical why we're trying to do it. The next point, the third point, and there are two here. There's like 3A and 3B. So 3A is the mother is kind. So we've got to navigate this because we think, what a bizarre idea. So what's the logic here? And it's not how we think, you know. When we think a person is kind, I'm sorry to say it, it's totally self-centered. That means they've done what I want. I mean, the girl in the cafe who serves me and smiles at me and gives me an extra piece of cake with extra cream and a discount, I'll call her kind. Why? Because she did what my attachment wanted. She might talk to the cook and think, well, who's that fat old ugly Australian nun, and laugh at me. I don't care. She gave me a discount and an extra piece, because if she's kind to me, she must be kind. But, you know, we don't care, because we're just so junky to get what I want. So a person who does my attachment wants, they must be kind. Rubbish. Now, the point here is not that point. This is the point that's quite difficult for us. Kind here means has done anything at all to help me. So this includes, you know, for example, you talk about your mum. One of the commonest things in the world that people would definitely say, if your mother gave you away at birth, let's say. The pain and suffering of so many people who've been given away. Okay, we talked about karma. We didn't mention that one. But if we understand karma, that's a very different discussion. But here, there's not a single logical reason we can come up with about how she's been kind. Well, that is just not true. That is just not true. She didn't abort you. Okay? She didn't. One person, not many people I know, have made a conscious decision. Remember when I told you I had an abortion when I was 23, and a friend I had who was 17 having a baby decided she would not have an abortion. She decided she would not have, she consciously decided not to have an abortion. It was very difficult. She was a Catholic. She was 17 in the 60s, but she risked her reputation. She had the baby and she gave the baby away. Now her motivation, I know her, was so pure that it broke her heart later. I guarantee that girl never once thinks how kind her mother was. So if you've been given away, you should be weeping daily with gratitude that your mum didn't abort you. This is a fact. This is a scientific fact. But we don't think of that. Because we, you know, it's understandable. So kind here is, so then you think maybe your mum didn't abort you, or maybe your mum didn't give you away, but she's neurotic. But when we understand karma from junior school, when we understand samsara, guess what? Join the universe, please. What, you know, when we realize how deep our attachment is, and when we looked at attachment and saw that it's this massive kind of sense of entitlement, attachment is this incredible hungry, and it's understandable, we've all got it, this emotional hunger, this assumption that I should only get the nice things. So I think especially our mothers, and especially if we have the materialist view and she literally made us, then we have this view, absolute, that she had better be perfect. And she had better do only goods for me. And how dare my mother dare to harm me? We are so shocked by that. Which is why we mostly blame mums, you know. Well, if we have the view of karma, we know it's not like that. We created the course to go to that mum's womb. We've got this history together. And we get the mum we deserve. So when you know that already, dealing with it in karma, you're already stable. And now you can afford to look and start looking at your mum in a different way. So yes, my mum's neurotic. Yes, she was depressed. Yes, she made bad choices. I mean, so what's special? We're in samsara. When you understand that, and then second, you understand that you chose, not chose, but ran like a magnet due to your karma to that particular mother, and you're in this dynamic together, then you can see your mother freshly. And now you can start, and it's a very powerful exercise for all of us, I think, to then consciously start writing a list of the things she has done to help you. Now, that's curious, too, because I remember one sister, she did some things for me, and I said, oh, you're so kind. She said, what do you mean kind? It's just natural. So that's what we tend to think about our mum. So we say, well, you know, she kept you in her womb for several months. I think that's pretty incredible. If you're a mum, you know how incredible that is. And I guarantee you, your mum thought about you every day and tried to feed you properly and give you the right food and worried if you're kicking or not. And then she gave birth to you, which is a pretty intense experience. I mean, excuse me, but to this, you'd be dead. She mightn't have felt so happy. That's not the issue here. Then from that time, she wiped your dirty bottom. She stayed up at night. She fed you. I mean, you could have a list of hundreds of things. Yes, she might have been unhappy. Yes, she was depressed. Yes, she was neurotic. Yes, she got angry. But look at the good things. In other words, bare bones, look at all the things that she did that even just simply facilitated your life. You can't deny she did them. Well, that's what kind means. The fact that she did them at all. This is profound. So guess what? If you do this, you'll be slowly painting a new picture of your mum. Suddenly she'll appear like a nice person to you now. Because instead of seeing her through the lens of anger, how dare she, you'll start to have a bit of a soft heart. This is really profound, very simple. This is not like emptiness. It won't squeeze you. You have to squeeze your brain, as Lama Yeshe said. You've got to squeeze your heart. Then the 3B, all the Lamas say, this is more profound. And this is based on interdependence. But it's a similar idea. Except it's more radical. It goes like this. All sentient beings are kind. I mean, this is like an absurdity on the face of it, you know. 5 o'clock. I've got to stop at 5, right?
Yes.
Yep. We could go 5 minutes over. Couldn't we? What are you going to do for half an hour? Have a break. And we've got to come back at 5:30. Oh, you got to. Oh, she's got to change that. She's got to organize. Okay, ready. We're fine. We're fine. So, here then, let's look at the logic. And this is a marvelous one, actually. If you think about this, this is dependent arising. Think from the time of your conception in your mother's womb. There is not a single thing that has facilitated your life up until now that hasn't been the handiwork of countless sentient beings, and indeed the life and death of countless sentient beings. This is logic. This is scientific fact. But we never think this way. Why? Because we just take it as a given. We assume it's our right to get the nice socks that you want and the clothes you need and the best glasses and the best everything, because we're totally self-centered. We have an assumption that we deserve the right things and I'm paying for it anyway. But when you start to see it in this way and realize that countless sentient beings, since you were conceived, it's the entire universe. I mean, or the other way to look at it is everything that you wear, everything that, you know, like this, and the carpet, and your clothing, and your iPad, and the cup, everything you use, everything that facilitates your life, the heating in your house, everything is the handiwork of sentient beings. The handiwork of sentient beings. This is profound. This is outrageous. And this should immediately soften our heart, you know, when you take things for granted. This is simply logic, but who ever thinks it? And again, this is a shock to us. What do you mean they're kind? I mean, the person who made my socks, and I love my particular socks that I choose. They're navy blue. I like navy blue. They're very light. They don't have heels, so you can turn them over. You get double wear from them. They don't make holes. They're really cute. They're light. I love my socks. What if the person who invented those is a pedophile? That's not our business here. We don't care. Maybe that waitress is a pedophile too. I don't care. That's not the issue here. It's got nothing to do with what they're like. It's the fact that they did it at all. This is, and the issue here is trying to open our hearts to realize that everything that facilitates our life is the handiwork of real sentient beings. They say even with the mother one, the yogis who experience the truth of that. There's this yogi, I think. Wasn't there this yogi in his cave called Always Crying One, a bodhisattva? Every time he saw anything, he'd burst into tears because it reminded him of sentient beings, you know, mother sentient beings. I mean, this is huge if we think about it. This is, I mean, I think, you know, sometimes I think about the bodhisattva teachings. And Lama Zopa, when I saw him one time just recently, he sort of said, "Do you teach about bodhicitta?" And I kind of blurted out, "Oh, it's too hard for me, which I can't cope." I'd rather talk about emptiness. I feel safer talking about emptiness, I tell you. This stuff blows my mind. We talked about the 8 verses, you know. It's outrageous stuff. It's outrageous stuff. Not normal. It's not like the world thinks. I mean, the 8 verses, they were kept secret back in the 8th century, whatever it was, 10th century. They were kept secret because they're such outrageous teachings. Even these, simply seeing that, you know, people facilitate your life, so how kind they are. So then the point of this, the conclusion is number 4, I must repay their kindness. Each of these steps is moving us very incrementally, very gradually, very kind of organically towards developing love and compassion and eventually bodhicitta. It takes it very gently. Each step leads to the next. And people spend years doing these meditations until they find, like the example I gave you about Harry, falling off the mountain, you know. The proof of the pudding, as we say in English. These are intense points, and each is very precise. We're not used to thinking that there's logic and analysis when it comes to developing love and compassion. We don't think that way because we just think they're gooey feelings. They're not. It's stable realization, stable logic, stable recognition of things, conceptual stories, you know. Are we communicating? 4 minutes. Let's ask some questions then. Just a couple of points I made there. Any questions before we finish? No? Nothing? You happy? Makes sense. Okay, good. No questions. About anything. All right. We can finish. So we think here we've been just 45 minutes or 43 minutes or something. As many moments as there have been, as many seeds we've planted. How I think about that, how marvelous. All these thoughts. They've gone in, nothing goes astray. Remember that? As Lama Zopa says, we're like we're taking pictures all day, photos, and they all get stored in our mind. So we think, how marvelous. All these seeds we've planted, may we nourish them from this moment forward with our effort, our practice. Why? So just as we motivate it, so we can develop our marvelous potential, so we can be a benefit to others. Thinking like this. Changchub, Semchog, Rinpoche, Ma Kie Panam, Kie Gyu Chig, Kie Pa Nyampa, Me Pa Yang, Gong Ne Gong Du, Pel Ba Sho, Ge Wa Din, Nyu Du Dag, Lama Sangye, Drub Gyu Ne, Dro Wa Ti Kyang, Ma Lu Pa, De Yi Sa La, Ge Pa Sho. Okay, we see each other in half an hour for our prison project talk or something. Yes, that's right. Here, that's right. I know, do some. I know. Do some talk. I know. Well, I'll manage. I'll talk something.
Also, that part will be streamed for everybody.
Oh, well, okay. I understand. Okay, fine. Okay, hi, people. Hi. Okay, hi. Okay. For those who are listening, okay, hi, people. Hi, people on the radio. Okay, so we see each other at 5:30 here. Okay, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.